Today I went to a meeting of kind of a gathering, informal gathering of some of the Spirit Rock teachers, about six or seven Spirit Rock teachers, together with Joseph Goldstein, just to hang out with him and have kind of Dharma discussion. And it was quite lovely just to kind of meet with people and, you know, have Dharma discussion of that kind. And there were many topics we covered. But the first topic that we addressed was the topic of joy. And we were prompted to talk about it because we were asked by James Barres, because he's writing a book about joy. So he was kind of mining us. He thought, this is a good, you know, group of friends. I could ask my friends, you know. They won't get annoyed. And so what do you know about joy? Joy in the practice and joy in Buddhism. And it was very interesting. Then we went around the circle, and everyone had something to say about joy. One person said that in the early years of her practice, Vipassana practice, joy had not been emphasized in the practice, and so she had the sense that can everybody hear okay? The speaker's working. Oh no! Oh, it's too soft. I'm sorry. Speak up earlier. Anybody can interrupt any time. This is an informal place, so if any time you don't think it's loud enough, so it depends a little bit. It's a little hard for the person at the commands because, they said it at one point, and then I talk softer for that day. So one person talked about how in the early years of her practice, teachers didn't emphasize the importance of joy or the role of joy in practice, and she got the message that, you know, Dharma practice is kind of grim, you know, serious, really serious stuff, and you have to bear down and face your suffering and deal with your suffering and look at your suffering and work with your suffering and it's all about suffering and being present for suffering was kind of what she heard, and it took many years for her to realize there was a whole other side of practice. And other teachers going around the circle talked about how important, what an important role joy had in their practice, and talked about the different flavors of joy, different aspects of joy. And it was kind of, it's very inspiring for me to sit there and be part of that discussion about joy. And so I don't want to summarize what was talked about at the meeting. But I do want to spend some time talking about joy for you, and its importance, and maybe it'll be useful for you to look at it. You don't have to read very far in the discourses of the Buddha to come across a lot of times where the Buddha talked about the importance of having developing a sense of well-being in practice. And he didn't use the word well-being, but he used a whole series of words, joy and happiness and delight and gladness and contentment, and a lot of different words that kind of belong to that family that maybe we'd call the family of joy or the family of happiness. There's a great quote where the Buddha said, or I don't know if it's the Buddha, but it's quoted in the early discourses of people who are enlightened are said to drink the joy of the Dharma, drink Dharma joy. And drinking is pretty kind of, you know, physical kind of sense of, you know, you're actually drinking in and imbuing yourself with this kind of joy, delight. And over and over again in the practice instruction of the Buddha, this family of emotions or feelings or states related to joy play a very important part. One of the very powerful roles, at least for me as I read the text in my practice, is that concentration is supported by happiness. That if you want to get concentrated, perhaps you should first get happy. And now that's a very difficult paradox for many people who come to meditation, because many people come to meditation because there's some form of unhappiness, And then you're told, well, you can't meditate until you get happy. You know, that doesn't work. And a very important part of mindfulness practice, and this was made very, very clear in this discussion we had about joy, is that a very important part of mindfulness practice is a very honest addressing of suffering and distress and all the kind of grief and sorrow that we might feel. And some people feel a kind of joy and delight. People have come and told me that they've come to a Dharma talk. And the Dharma talk was about the Four Noble Truths, about suffering and the cause of suffering and freedom from suffering and suffering and suffering and feeling a joy and delight because they felt that there was an aspect of human life that was unsatisfactory, that was stressful, or was kind of something inherent about life that was unsatisfactory, or that popular society, their families, never addressed, never talked about. And they had this hunch, something is a little bit off in this world, something is a little bit out of kilter. And they go around to different places and they say, you know, people just want to make a positive message and say everything's great and wonderful. And these are the people I've talked to, and they maybe didn't go around so far, but and then they come and they hear a Dharma talk, and they say that the Buddha seemed to talk very honestly about what I intuited for a long time. Finally, I'm meeting someone who actually talks about suffering, looks at it right in the face, and it makes them happy. It's kind of that honesty of really looking at it. So a very important part of Dharma practice is this honest addressing of looking and being present for life as it is, and often that involves a degree of suffering. But there's another aspect of Dharma practice, and that is not just simply what we face, what we kind of wake up to, what we look at, but also reality or life involves what happens to us and what we do in response to life, what we act, how we act, what we do. And we play a role in our experience of the world. And so what the Buddha said is you should take some responsibility for what your role is in your experience of this life. And if it's just a matter of just being present and being present, being present, being mindful of what's happening, what's being mindful of what's happening, that's a powerful practice. But it's not the same thing as actually taking responsibility for what you're contributing to the world and actually kind of changing yourself in some way, adjusting yourself so your mental states, your attitude, your disposition is a little more helpful for Dharma practice itself, helpful for this process of waking up. And one of the ways of taking responsibility is to have some sense of the possibilities that are inherent within us, like joy and happiness or concentration or calm or contentment, tranquility, some of the things that are helpful for Dharma practice, and then be open to its possibility. Allow for make space for its possibility. And I say that to a culture which often is going at 100 miles an hour, going very fast, and in a culture where people are often trying to fill their time to the maximum. The maximum efficiency in recreational opportunities. Or whatever, you know, we're always pursuing something, you know, and multitasking and, you know, doing a lot of different things. Some people don't do it that way. Some people have very different lives. But as a culture as a whole, there's often a tremendous drive and push from the culture itself almost to do, 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 do. And that kind of life sometimes doesn't leave room for the allowing of a possibility to bubble up inside of us. And I suggest to you that the spiritual life in Buddhism has a lot to do with making space for something that's actually quite shy deep inside of us to surface and bubble up and appear and show itself. And if we're always busy and always engaged, then it can't bubble up. And engaged doesn't only mean engaged in activities, but it also can mean engaged in our thinking. And some people crowd their lives with their thinking. They're kind of claustrophobic. Or that's not the right word, I guess. But just kind of, they just kind of fill their, they're kind of always engaged in something they're thinking about. And the idea that there's life outside of thinking is a foreign idea. Just like, what? and I know it was a foreign idea to me until I started Dharma practice and meditation practice. And it isn't that we have to stop thinking, but there's a way in which the mind is always kind of grabbing on or engaged in or obsessed in or thinking about something, and as if life depends on it, or it's very important, or that's where life is found, is by reviewing the conversation we had yesterday and improving what we said, or planning what's going to happen tomorrow, or thinking about something, this or that. And it's quite humbling for me to sit down to meditate and to realize how often my mind has a mind of its own in this regard. And my mind is thinking and wants to think, and I can tell it don't think, and it doesn't listen, like a 2-year-old or something. And so it's a part of practice is also to learn how to make space in the mind so that the mind is not always engaged or obsessing or caught up in what it wants to think about. And when we start disengaging a little bit from our thinking world, we start making some space in the heart or in the mind for some new possibility to arise. And in that space of possibility, one of the things that we can also do is then try to lean in the direction or try to encourage or nourish certain states of mind or dispositions which are helpful for the development of meditation. And one of those things is happiness or joy or delight, gladness. To begin seeing, can we cultivate and make space for happiness? I suspect that all of you have some occasion or reason to feel some degree of joy or delight or contentment or something. It could be very, very minor. It could be so minor, it's just simply you're happy it's not raining today. You know, it's a certain kind of happiness. Maybe it hadn't occurred to you. Or maybe you'd be happier if it rained, I don't know. But maybe it's a silly example, but I apologize for it. But the idea is that it's possible to relax, to stop a little bit and look around and what is happening right now that can give us some joy and satisfaction. And to let that joy and satisfaction feed us, drink it in, and let it nourish who we are. Make space for it. If we're always kind of going around and not making space for it, then it's not going to nourish us. It's not going to create, it's not going to tenderize the mind. It's not going to help the mind relax. Happiness is one of the ways to help the mind relax. Joy is one of the ways to get the mind to relax. And when the mind begins to relax, that's when the kind of the meditation path begins to open up. So you find a lot of emphasis on joy in the teachings of the Buddha. And you find different lists where joy appears or happiness appears or different kind of parts of that family. And there's different kinds of joy then, different kinds of happiness. There's a kind of joy which is taking joy in other people's joy. And that's a very important part of traditional Buddhist practice, is when you encounter someone who's happy for some good reason, share in their happiness, as opposed to being envious of them. You know, how could they? You know, they shouldn't be happy. And but to begin tuning in that space of the mind that quiets down, actually being interested in other people who are happy and their happiness, and kind of ride piggyback on it. You know, it's fine to do that. I don't know if you're necessarily borrowing it because you don't have to pay it back, but you can kind of share in their joy. It's kind of a form of empathy. And that empathy is considered a very important part of Buddhist practice, the empathy that we share in other people's joy. Wow, that person's happy. That person succeeded in something. That's really great. I'm happy in it. Wow, that's great. And if you've never been told that's a useful principle to do, maybe it wouldn't occur to you to do that. But that's part of the teachings of the Buddha. Another kind of joy is a kind of joy or delight or gladness in ethical behavior in the world. So it's also kind of looking around in the world and seeing, yeah, there are some good people out there. And there might be people who are not so good. It's quite easy to read the newspaper. And it's interesting to read the newspaper. But the newspaper doesn't often champion or delight in a lot of the virtues that people do. And so to go around and tune into the virtue, the delight, the ethics that exists in our society and culture. I find tremendous delight when I meet someone who I feel is quite ethical. The people who I've known people who have done the slightest little misstatement, said something was a little bit off. You know, They kind of talking maybe a little bit too fast and said something that wasn't quite, you know, strictly honest. Though it was fine, you know, basically they were, and they come back the next day and they said, you know, I need to ask for forgiveness. I need to confess, you know, I wasn't quite, you know, right, you know. And I said yesterday that you know, I had a great meal. You know, I was a little bit exaggerating. I meant that it was a good meal. that example never happened, but I've had people, you know, who kind of came to make very small kind of confessions, and it seemed unnecessary to me when they've made them, but it made me very happy that someone in the world wanted to do that. They were motivated enough, had that sense of ethics that they wanted to do that. And then there's a kind of happiness that comes with our own ethics, being ethical ourselves. And in Buddhism, we're encouraged, certainly, to be ethical, to live an ethical life. But almost more important is than being ethical is to avail yourself of a certain kind of joy or delight that comes from, and relaxation that comes from being ethical. So it isn't ethical for the sake of just being ethical. It's ethical because when you're ethical, it's easier to be relaxed. Someone said, you should be honest because you should be honest because then you have less to remember. You know, you can tell a lie, and I've known people who've talked about, you know, tell a lie and then they have to make another lie to cover that lie, and then they have to remember the lies they made, and it gets quite complicated, the web of lies. But if you're honest, you don't have to remember. So you're more relaxed. So, and also a certain happiness. And this was one of the big surprises for me when I went to Southeast Asia, to Buddhist Asia, was to encounter people who felt joy in their own ethics, because it was not a message I'd learned in America at all, in the circles I traveled in. In fact, the sense I got was that if you were ethical, you were kind of a goody-goody, and you don't want to be a goody-goody person, you know. Something wrong with someone who was too good. But the idea of delighting in your own goodness, your own ethical behavior, was something that surprised me, and delighted me when I realized that it was possible. And there have been times when that's been a source of delight for me, a very palpable kind of delight. And there are times when my ethics have been the opposite. And one of the amazing things to do is to do something unethical, and then go try to sit a retreat and meditate. I mean, then you really know, boy, I shouldn't have done that. Because it kind of comes, it follows you along, and your mind's obsessing and concerned, your heart's broken, and you feel the yuckiness of it. And it's sometimes very difficult to let go of it. And to go on retreat, you know, in daily life you can distract yourself from it. But you go on retreat after doing something, and then having done that, and then going on retreat some other time, and realizing, well, I didn't do anything bad, anything unethical, and then showing up and, well, this is really good, you know, I'm not being burdened by all this remorse and regret and all this that I have. So then, you know, to take time to feel some happiness in one's own ethics, in one's own good behavior. It's sometimes hard in a culture where people feel there's something inherently wrong with them to begin with, you know, original sin or something. But Buddhism has more the notion of original, if anything. It's not, you can't quite make the parallel statement in Buddhism, but if anything, in contrast to original sin, Buddhism would argue that there's original luminosity within us, original purity within us. So that's a starting point for Buddhists, is more a sense of some innate goodness that we have rather than some innate inadequacy. One of the forms of joy in Buddhism that's very important for meditation is sometimes translated into English as rapture. And rapture is connected to the word rapt, like a rapt interest, another word. And so rapture in Buddhism, like in meditation, is a kind of joy that comes when there's a rapt interest in what you're doing. Or when you're engaged in something, and you're so wholeheartedly engaged in something that the wholeheartedness itself brings a kind of joy and delight bubbling up. And this is one of the keys to meditation practice, is if we can get so interested in the process of meditation itself, that we're so involved in it that rapture just begins bubbling up, this engage, this, we lose ourselves and forget ourselves in the process of meditation, so that this joy can arise. That's not so different than perhaps the joy of maybe reading a really good book, and we get absorbed in it, and there's kind of delight or satisfaction or joy that can sometimes arise. Or some hobby, or playing a musical instrument. You get really absorbed in it, and some kind of joy can arise on its own. Same thing in meditation. And this is very important to realize, because sometimes when we sit down to meditate, the mind thinks that something else is much more important than meditation itself. And thinks that reviewing the past or planning the future or whatever, some fantasy, is much more important. And so it's kind of training. Meditation is partly a training of the mind, so that the mind begins to learn that it's actually not that interesting to review conversations or plan the future. It doesn't really do you much good. And there's actually much, much, much more fascinating and wonderful and precious things to do with human life when you sit down to meditate than obsessing your thoughts. Now, so begin having some inkling that that's true, and then having that inkling grow and grow and become kind of a really clear understanding or conviction, or I think it's part of what happens in meditation practice. So it becomes easier and easier to not be fooled by the obsessive thinking, not be fooled by the attempts to try to fix our life by thinking about things over and over and over again. But be like, oh, I can let go of this. Or I think I can do something much more important with my life right now than engage in my thinking. I can kind of get engaged in this process of meditation, following the breath, being constantly absorbed in what's going on. And the more absorbed we get, then at some point this rapt joy can arise sometimes. And that rapt kind of joy can be subtle, and it can be extremely intense. I had one teacher, Vipassana teacher in Thailand, who he was kind of an odd teacher, I thought. And I came to him as a Zen priest, Zen monk. And maybe he had kind of high expectation of how concentrated I could get. And so I would do these interviews. I was doing solitary practice in a little cabin by myself. But every day I had an interview with him. And after a few days of doing interviews with him, he started asking me these questions. And I said, are you shaking yet? Are you trembling yet? Are you bouncing yet? Really, what's going on here? And then after some more days, he said, oh, just, a few weeks ago, we had this Brazilian woman practicing here. And she had this tremendous, this concentration that built up, this rapt kind of joy. And she was literally bouncing off the walls in her hut, kind of shaking and bouncing. And because sometimes when this rapt interest is very, very intense, it can feel like, apparently I've never seen anybody jumping around, bouncing around, but you can feel that way. It's tremendous, sometimes it can feel like these, it feels like this, like you're the ocean and these huge waves are rising in you and then breaking over you and just washing you. Joy, can you imagine joy? Have you ever had that experience? Maybe like an orgasm? And I tried to eat lunch once when this was happening. And every time I picked up the spoon, just picking up the spoon, you have to be a little bit concentrated to pick up the spoon, right? You have to be focused on something. And so I'd pick up the spoon, and all that concentration would somehow get triggered, and this kind of joy. And I'd be so overwhelmed by this cascading of joy, I had to put the spoon down. It was too much. And I'd try again. And it took forever to eat that lunch. A long time. And so it can be quite intense at times. It doesn't have to be, but it can be. There's a joy of having a practice. I find a lot of joy and satisfaction with having a Dharma practice. There may be many things in life that are comparable, but for me, this is what I found. That helps, that gives me kind of a sense of having a path in this life, a path in the life of suffering, a path out of suffering, a path to freedom, a path to joy, a path to love and compassion. And so I've been involved in this Buddhist path for so long that I have tremendous confidence in it. And it gives me a sense of joy and delight to have found something like this and to have found a path that I feel is, or I know, is so effective and so helpful, leading to a freedom which is, as far as I know, incomparable, and it's just incomparable. So that brings a sense of joy and delight. There's also a kind of joy that... one of the discussions we had today was the difference between enjoyment and joy. Now, this is all a matter of definition, and you might use these words differently than how I'm going to use it now. So please, you know, think about the definition I'm using and not the word. So enjoyment, I define as an involvement with what is joyful, with what is pleasant or enjoyable. So a sunset might be bring joy. It might be enjoyable. And then there's the active involvement with that pleasure of watching a sunset. The mind might think, this is the best sunset I've ever seen. This is wonderful. Let me just linger here with it. Let me just kind of, you know, just kind of lay here in the sand or the beach and just kind of really soak in the last of the rays and just kind of, you know, can we get involved? There's kind of a, maybe some kind of clinging or attachment to that kind of that joy that's happening. There's some involvement and engagement with it. And one of the forms of engagement with joy is to think about it. This is I'm having a great time. One of the very interesting things about thinking about what brings us joy, thinking about that sunset, how wonderful it is more often than not, I believe, when we think about it, it actually separates us a little bit from that joy. And that when we stop thinking about what's making us happy, we're actually getting a chance to sink deeper into the happiness or let it experience more fully, let it blossom more. There's a separation from the enjoyable thing when we think too much about what's enjoyable, even while we're experiencing it. Is that making sense to you? And so part of the training in practice is to learn how to let go of the thinking or the engagement with or the clinging to or the trying to hold on to the joy we have. And just let it be there kind of freely without any concern about how long it stays, whether it leaves in a minute or leaves in an hour or leaves in a day, or any concern with, you know, making it mine or thinking about it. Just let it be. Let the joy be very free, independent of your self concept or trying to make yourself, you know, do something with it. Just let the joy be by itself. Now, this is a very important training, because in Dharma practice, one of the deepest forms of joy is a joy that arises, we can say, for no reason at all. And most people have a sense that joy arises for a reason. You win the lottery and you maybe feel joyful or maybe not. Or, you know, you get some wonderful compliment from someone, or you have some success in life, or something happens. But there's also a kind of joy that can happen when we relax enough and are relaxed enough in our mind, relaxed enough in our concepts and our thoughts, that that nothing stands in the way of an innate sense of well-being, innate sense of delight or love or joy, that kind of almost can be seen as, I'm repeating myself, I'm sorry, as innate, as, you know, who we are. A kind of a joy that is not dependent on anything, a kind of a joy, a kind of state of mind, a kind of happiness that it can arise, that exists when our minds, when our consciousness, when our awareness is not relating to anything. And usually our thinking is relating to something. Now, right now, most of you are relating to this talk, unless you're getting bored and thinking about something else. Then you're relating to something else. But you're relating to something. And the mind is directed at something. When the mind is no longer directed at anything, so it's kind of like a, you know, like a lighthouse. You know, the way a lighthouse works, the light is directed, you know, and the beam of light is directed in some direction as the lighthouse goes around. Usually it's directed and, you know, goes around. And at some point, perhaps, the lighthouse keeper maybe removes all the shutters from the light, and then the light just radiates out in all directions. It doesn't have a direction anymore. At some point, the mind is not directed towards anything. It's not concerned about anything. It's not trying to make anything happen, not trying to understand itself in relationship to anything else. But the mind just stands free and independent of all things. Thinking process is not engaged in anything in particular, maybe nothing at all. The mind is a kind of, it becomes, some people talk, the mind rests in itself. And this is considered to be the incomparable happiness of freedom. There's a possibility of the mind not relating to anything at all. And that's a very, I think, maybe a very foreign idea to most people, because most people don't even know that their mind is always relating to something. And then to even know there's an alternative to that for the mind is a radical shift in understanding what's possible in the human mind. And so this, the deepest form of happiness, the deepest joy, and I would say the most satisfying form of happiness is a happiness that has no reason, but rather is that happiness is there when the mind rests in itself, when the heart rests in itself. And in doing so, includes everything within it. So in giving this talk about joy, my hope has been that I can encourage you to appreciate joy a little bit more, its value, that you could try to make more space for it in your life, and in healthy ways, in appropriate ways, see if you can let your happiness, a sense of well-being, be a guide for you for finding a greater and greater freedom in your life. If you're finding yourself less and less happy, you're probably moving away from freedom. And stop and look at that, and can you adjust for that? Can you change for that? I think all too many people are willing to suffer. All too many people are willing to go along with discomfort or with becoming contracted or feeling stress. We feel certain stress, we feel it's really important to do X, Y, and Z. And so we know we're going to be stressful doing that, but getting those done are more important than avoiding the stress. And how many times do we sacrifice our well-being? And is it really necessary? And I think part of the challenge of Buddhist practice is to look honestly at all the situations in your life where you sacrifice your sense of well-being for some cause, whatever it might be, even the smallest one possible. And question that. And the suggestion tonight is that maybe you shouldn't choose to sacrifice your well-being. Maybe you should choose to go, when you have a choice, to come back to your sense of well-being and not go with the stress, not go with the distress, not go with the anxiety or the tightness or the constriction if you can. Because in that space of happiness or well-being, that is where the food exists for a deepening of the meditative life. So what do you think? Do you have any questions or comments about this? Yes.
Your description of joy. Please wait for the microphone.
You know, if we kept the mic right up here, then when I ask for questions or something, I'm just kind of ready to.
In your description of joy being the mind resting in itself or having joy in itself, metta was brought to mind. Can you contrast? Is there any contrast between joy and metta in that sense?
Metta, loving kindness meditation, is usually in relationship to something. So we have this feeling of kindness or good intentions towards you, or towards myself, or towards the whole room of people. It's usually in relationships, and so the mind is in relationship then. And it's a very important form of practice. And there's a lot of joy and delight or concentration that can arise from doing loving kindness practice. Usually people don't associate it with the kind of joy that comes from just the mind resting, the heart resting in itself. Though sometimes it feels that way. It feels that sometimes loving kindness is a state, or some people say compassion is a state, that seems to bubble out or radiate out from a heart which is resting in itself. And it has no object. It's just a kind of we feel all this love, but it's not love, it's undirected love. It's not love towards anybody in particular. One of the about the discussion today about joy is the distinction between the different elements, different members of that joy family or happiness family, and in the way that Buddhism defines joy, happiness is more sublime. So it's a more sublime state or experience. And even more sublime, or more, in a kind of paradoxical way, happier than happiness, more sublime or more satisfying or more deepening or more peaceful than happiness is equanimity. So there's often this movement in Buddhism from joy to happiness to equanimity. And sometimes, I've talked a lot about, I used the word joy a lot today. But we want to be very careful in Buddhist practice not to overvalue joy either. Joy has a very important role in practice, but also there's a time when we want to move to something that's better than joy, or deeper than joy. We want to let the practice go deeper. And so it's very important then to know when to let go of joy so that we can kind of move into this deeper levels of peace, so the mind can find that place where it rests in itself. And it's considered in the tradition that it's, or it is, I believe, very transformative for people to discover the heart that rests in itself, or the mind that rests in itself, or the mind which relates to nothing, stands independent, free. Because then it's kind of like knowing there's a home inside of us that's, or some place of refuge that we have, or some place of peace, or that is not dependent on what happens in the world around us. And so we don't have to kind of neurotically always be looking for the world to provide us, or the situations in the world to provide us with our happiness. But we know that it exists deep inside of us. And so the kind of drive then to for greed or for hate, the energy for it, the fuel for it, begins to abate. Because we realize we have something that's more precious or more lasting or more enduring or more valuable than the kind of happiness and joy we're going to get from real estate or bank accounts or relationships or many of the things that people often invest everything in. And so our relationship to the world begins to shift in Buddhism is considered a very healthy way. Anything else? Anybody feel dissatisfied with this talk or unhappy about it?
When you said equanimity is, as it were, a stage above happiness,
yeah.
How would you define equanimity then?
Equanimity is a mind which is so balanced in itself, so at ease with itself, so settled on itself, there's no tendency in the mind to react for and against anything. So the mind stays balanced, stays equanimous. It's not ruffled by what goes on. Some forms of it, it's so deep in the peace of itself that things aren't experienced as painful anymore, or either pleasure and pain is not experienced anymore. There's no pleasure and pain in that experience because the mind is so even and settled. And it turns out that experience with no pleasure and pain is a very happy one. very peaceful and very satisfying one. I think you have to almost experience it to understand. Is that clear enough? I have probably an inadequate answer, but the best I could. Sometimes it makes me happy to know that these cell phones, you know, they're great, you know. So all these people who you know, talk to their mothers, or you know, they wouldn't otherwise, because it's so convenient. They call up and say hello. It's really great, you know. No, it's great. You know, there's all these benefits our society has from them, and it's just. It's your choice, isn't it? Whether something makes you happy or something makes you distressed or upset. Do you take responsibility for that? Take some responsibility and lighten up. Anyway, thank you so much for tonight.